Evening, buyer's remorse. Buy a new car? I'll be moving in. Let's get started.
Sorry, I think there's been a mistake. I bought it from Carvana.
You what?
Yeah, great price. I even have 7 days to love it or return it.
So there's no...
No buyer's remorse. More like buyer's rejoice.
I guess I'll let myself out. Congratulations. I mean it.
Buyer's rejoice. Buy your car today on Carvana.
Limitations and exclusions may apply. See our 7-day return policy at Carvana.com.
Welcome to the Divergent Files podcast.
In 1964, something weird happened to America on live television. And it wasn't one thing, it was a bunch of things. And together, they made reality feel like it split in half. The country people thought they lived in, and the country showing up on their screens, were no longer the same place. Kids screaming like they were possessed when the Beatles appeared on Ed Sullivan. Civil rights protesters getting beaten in the streets, while families watched from the couch holding TV dinners. A presidential campaign ad implying nuclear annihilation could happen at any second. Vietnam shifting from something over there into a machine that would eventually consume more than 58,000 American lives. China getting the atomic bomb. Muhammad Ali rejecting the identity the country handed him in public, on camera, in front of everybody. So something changed in 1964, and it wasn't just politically. It changed the way people understood what was happening around them. Like the country switched channels and never fully switched it back. And here's where it gets uncomfortable. On this channel, we've already looked at three strange pressure points, 1988, 2012, and 2036. Each one sitting 24 years apart. At first, it looked like an interesting pattern, and I know, patterns are dangerous. You can make a pattern out of almost anything if you squint hard enough. But then I made the mistake of going backward, one more turn of the wheel, to 1964. And that's when the pattern stopped feeling like a pattern and started feeling like a warning. And not because one event proves anything by itself, because it doesn't. But when you put that year in one frame, the music, the riots, the war machine, the nuclear fear, the way people started seeing themselves on television, 1964 starts looking less like a busy year and more like the moment modern reality began getting rewritten through the screen. And if that year fits the cycle too, then 1988 may not have been the beginning. Now, the question gets ugly. How long has this thing been repeating? And what exactly happens every time the cycle comes back around? So the problem with patterns is that eventually they start staring back at you. And that's where this whole thing went sideways for me. Because we already looked at 1988, then 2012, then 2036. And every time we touched one of those years, the same weird feeling kept showing up underneath. Like something had shifted underneath normal life. 1988 felt like a reboot year. The old world starts dying, the Cold War cracks open, global finance starts mutating in the background, digital systems slide quietly underneath everyday life, while everyone's distracted buying neon windbreakers and microwaving pizza rolls. Then 2012 shows up 24 years later, and the internet stops feeling like a tool and starts feeling like just the weather. Algorithms start taking over attention. Social media hardens reality into tribes. And little by little, the feed becomes more emotionally real than the physical world sitting 5 feet away from you. And then we have 2036, and honestly, I still don't know what 2036 is. And that's the problem. Because the closer we get to it, the less symbolic it feels. We have AI, synthetic media, machines remembering more than we do, reality becoming editable in ways we've never had to deal with before. It feels less like a future year and more like a door sitting slightly open. So I went backward. Honestly, a lot of you kept asking me the same question in the comments. Okay, but what happens if you go back another 24 years? So I did. I went back to 1964. And yeah, that's when it got worse. That's when the pattern stopped feeling modern. because 1964 starts to look like an earlier reality transition, not through the algorithms, but through television. Civil rights footage, Vietnam entering the living room, nuclear fear, youth culture detonating all at once. The old America was still talking like it was 1955, while the new America was already coming through the screen. And nobody really understood what they were watching yet. And the weirdest part? 1964 does not feel like the beginning either. It feels like a checkpoint. Like whatever this thing is, it was already moving before anyone alive today was here to watch it. Now, does that prove a hidden cycle controls history? No, of course not. But sometimes patterns leave fingerprints before they leave proof. And this one is starting to leave fingerprints all over the damn wall. Because the first real clue may not be war, or politics, or even economics. It may be the glowing box sitting in America's living room, teaching millions of people to experience reality the same way at the exact same time. So the more I looked at 1964, the more one thing bothered me. It wasn't just a year people lived through. It was a year America watched together. And that sounds small now because we're drowning in screens, in phones, tablets, TikTok, everybody walking around like distracted aquarium fish, glowing blue in parking lots. But in 1964, television was becoming the closest thing America had to a national nervous system. And that changes everything. Earlier pressure points, like wars, depressions, assassinations, riots, moved through newspapers, radio, rumor, and speeches, so it was slower and more fragmented. But by 1964, millions of people could emotionally absorb the same images at almost the exact same time. And once I realized that, the whole year started feeling less political and more neurological. Not medically, emotionally. So this is where 1964 starts becoming more than a historical year. Because every era seems to have a control surface. Something people touch every day. Something that quietly teaches them what reality feels like. In the 1940s, it was radio and newspapers, film reels, speeches and war posters. By 1964, it was television. And that box wasn't just showing the world. It was teaching people how to feel about it. And that's power. Not the loud kind, the quieter kind that can change what millions of people feel before they ever get around to thinking. And once a control surface gets that deep into daily life, a reset, if that's what we're looking at, does not have to change the whole world. It only has to change the interface. So let's take the Beatles on Ed Sullivan, for example. About 73 million people watched that broadcast in February of 1964. That's roughly 40% of the entire country. 40%. Today, we can barely get people to agree on pizza toppings. Back then, almost half the country watched the same cultural detonation happen simultaneously. Parents watching their kids scream like civilization itself had been hacked. And honestly, maybe that's not the worst metaphor. Because Beatlemania was never just about music. It was people borrowing an identity from the screen. Hair, clothes, speech, attitude, the whole package. Youth suddenly pulling emotional authority away from parents, away from schools, churches, and politicians, and handing it to mass culture coming through a screen. And that shift matters more than people realize. Then there's the Daisy ad during the Johnson Goldwater election. One little girl counting flower petals before a nuclear countdown wipes the screen clean. The ad only aired once nationally. Once. And it still became one of the most infamous turning points in modern political advertising. And that's insane when you think about it. One national airing, that's all it took. 1 minute of television, and the nervous system learned a new trick. Not policy or emotion, it learned fear. The people using television had figured out something dangerous. People do not need long arguments if you can hit the nervous system directly. And hanging over all of this was Kennedy. 1964 did not begin with a clean nervous system. By 1964, the country was still standing inside the shadow of the assassination from the year before. People had watched a president's death become a television event. The breaking news.
From Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
The motorcade coverage, the funeral, the endless replay of grief. And even before the Zapruder film became widely seen years later, the idea of that footage was already haunting the culture, like a trauma loop nobody knew how to process. And that changes a country, especially when television kept rolling into civil rights violence, Vietnam footage, riots, protests, political ads, nuclear fear, and youth rebellion, all stacked on top of each other before the national nervous system had any time to breathe. And that's the part I don't think we fully appreciate now. 1964 was not just information. It was millions of people getting hit with the same emotional images at the same time, at a scale America was still learning how to survive. Fear, identity, politics, war, youth rebellion, all of it traveling through the same wire. And once television reached that scale, the experience of reality started getting centralized. Because when an entire country watches the same fear, the same music, the same war, and the same advertisements at the same time, that is not just media anymore. That is synchronized dreaming with commercials. And once the dream became synchronized, the next fight was over who got to appear inside the dream. By 1964, America had a serious problem. The story it told about itself and the footage coming through television screens were no longer matching. And once that starts happening to a country, things get unstable fast. Officially, America was selling itself as the shining city on the hill, with freedom, equality, democracy, the good guys. That was the pitch. Then people started seeing police dogs turn loose on protesters, fire hoses blasting teenagers into the walls, Black Americans attacked, threatened, and blocked from voting, crowds screaming at children walking into integrated schools. And not just hearing about it, they were watching it. And that hits a country differently. By then, the federal government knew the pressure was becoming impossible to ignore. So on July 2, 1964, Lyndon Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act into law. That's a documented fact. It outlawed segregation in many public places and banned employment discrimination based on race, color, religion, sex, or national origin. The National Archives describes it as the most sweeping civil rights legislation since Reconstruction. So that was real, a major correction to the legal structure of the country. But laws can move faster than psychology, and that's the problem. While America was updating the rules on paper, the country itself was still ready to blow. That same summer, Freedom Summer began in Mississippi. Young activists poured in, trying to register Black voters. Then, three civil rights workers disappeared in Neshoba County: James Chaney, Andrew Goodman, and Michael Schuwerner. Weeks later, investigators found their bodies buried in an earthen dam. Murdered. And this is where 1964 starts lining up with the other pressure points we've been tracking so far. Once again, the official story and lived reality split into two different worlds. The country says, we are free. The streets say, not for everybody. And television forces those two realities into the same room at almost the same time. That collision matters because it was not only moral, it was structural. These pressure years seem to come with the same kind of crack in public trust. 1940 shatters the illusion that modern war can stay far away. 1964 cracks the image America had of itself. 1988 destabilizes Cold War certainty. 2012 fractures shared reality through algorithms and social media. And 2036, if this pattern holds, that one may be the fracture between human decision-making and machine decision-making. But we'll survive that existential migraine later. The point is this: 1964 did not just change laws, it changed visibility. People could no longer pretend they did not see what they had already seen. That is a different kind of threshold. Maybe that is part of the cycle too, not just political change, but moments when people can't keep pretending the old story still works. But then another detail started bothering me. While America was trying to correct its image at home, another machine was spinning up overseas. And this one would not be fought with speeches. It would be measured in body counts. In August of 1964, something happened in the Gulf of Tonkin. Or at least something supposedly happened. This is where history does that thing it loves doing. A confusing event happens far away. The public gets a clean version. Congress moves fast. And suddenly, the machine has permission. According to the official story at the time, North Vietnamese patrol boats attacked the USS Maddox in the Gulf of Tonkin on August 2nd. Then came reports of a second attack on August 4th. And that second attack is where things start getting slippery. The deeper you dig into Tonkin, the harder it gets to avoid one ugly possibility. America may have been sold a clean version of events that key officials already knew was messy, uncertain, and maybe flat out wrong. Bad weather, confused radar signals, unclear sonar readings, jumpy men staring at screens in the dark trying to decide whether ghosts were torpedoes. The second attack, the one that helped justify the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, almost certainly did not happen the way the public was told it happened. Defense Secretary Robert McNamara later acknowledged that the August 4th attack was not what the country had been led to believe. Declassified material years later made the second alleged attack look even thinner. But by then, it didn't matter anymore. The machinery had already started moving. On August 7th, Congress passed the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution almost unanimously, which sounds boring until you realize what it did. It gave Lyndon Johnson broad authority to escalate military operations in Vietnam without Congress formally declaring war. More than 58,000 Americans eventually died in a war whose major escalation was sold through a story the public never got to fully verify. And honestly, this is one of the recurring fingerprints that keeps showing up in these pressure years. Not identical events, more like moments where emergency confusion, fear, or instability let power stretch farther than it could before. In 1940, it's total war mobilization and emergency government. In 1964, it's televised conflict, Cold War fear, and emergency authorization. By 1988, it shifts toward covert finance, intelligence games, and the digital wiring underneath globalization. By 2012, it moves into surveillance platforms, algorithmic influence, drone warfare, and behavioral tracking. And 2036? Look, I don't know. That's the one we're still walking toward. But if the pattern keeps mutating in the same direction, 2036 may be where automated systems start making security decisions faster than human beings can even understand them. Which sounds awesome right up until the robot thinks your mortgage application looks suspicious and sends something to circle your mailbox. Kidding. Mostly. But listen, Vietnam matters here because Tonkin feels like a hinge point. Before 1964, Vietnam was still psychologically distant for most Americans. You had advisors, you had containment policy, you had Cold War chessboard stuff. But after Tonkin, the door swings much wider. And then television follows the war into the living room. And that changes everything. Because now the same glowing box showing Americans Beatles concerts and sitcoms is about to show them body bags, jungle footage, napalm images, protests, draft cards, and eventually, one of the deepest trust collapses in modern American history. That's the cycle pressure again. If this pattern is telling us anything, it's that the system expands and the narrative cracks later. So while Washington was opening the war door overseas, American culture was busy finding a completely different kind of revolution. And this one came with guitars. By 1964, something else was clearly happening. The kids started tuning out. Not completely or overnight, but the emotional authority that had belonged to parents, churches, schools, presidents, and network anchors, it started slipping. And weirdly enough, one of the clearest warning signs was four British guys with bowl cuts. When the Beatles appeared on the Ed Sullivan Show in February of 1964, around 73 million people watched. Roughly 40% of the entire country. And that number is insane. Imagine 40% of America doing anything together now, besides complaining about gas prices. And adults watching that broadcast did not just see a band. A lot of them saw control leaving the room. Teenagers were screaming, crying, hyperventilating. then dressing differently, talking differently, and moving differently. The adults thought the kids were buying records, but they weren't. They were buying an exit ramp, because this was bigger than music. 1964 feels like one of the moments when identity stopped being something you mostly inherited and started becoming something the screen could hand you. And that's a real shift. Before this media era fully took hold, most people still got their sense of self locally. Your town, your church, your family, your neighborhood, the good old ways. Maybe your union if your uncle smoked enough cigarettes indoors to qualify. But then suddenly millions of kids were sinking emotionally through television, radio, magazines, celebrity culture, and shared symbols all at once. And in these cycles, people don't just change their opinion fast. A lot of times, they change themselves. So that's what keeps jumping out at me. The hair, voice, clothes, sex, language, music, even names. Maybe no figure captures that transition better than Cassius Clay becoming Muhammad Ali. Because that wasn't just a boxer changing his name. That was a man rejecting the identity the country expected him to keep, while the whole country watched. The new heavyweight champion of the world looked at the version of himself America was comfortable with and declined the update in front of everybody.
And I'm no longer Clay, I'm no longer a slave, so now I'm Muhammad Ali.
And parts of the country just lost their minds over it. And then that fall, Berkeley erupts with the free speech movement. Student protests start accelerating. Youth culture starts pulling against institutional authority across the country. And once again, television helps amplify it. That matters, because earlier generations rebelled too, obviously. But 1964 feels like one of the first moments when youth rebellion started happening on a national wavelength. It was a shared emotional frequency. Kids in California, New York, Mississippi, Detroit, and London started looking like they were responding to the same invisible signal. Not identical beliefs, but the same rhythm. And that distinction matters, because this is another fingerprint of the cycle. Not just political pressure, identity pressure. Moments when huge numbers of people stop accepting the roles they inherited and start rewriting themselves in public. 1940 mobilized bodies for war. 1964 mobilized identity. By 1988, it starts looking more like ambition and digital acceleration. By 2012, attention itself gets mobilized. In 2036, if this pattern holds, that one may involve the fight over what remains uniquely human once machines start shaping how people think in real time. But before we get there, something else happened in 1964 that almost nobody talks about enough. While America was busy reinventing itself culturally, another future was quietly being born through politics. One thing that kept surprising me while digging through 1964 was this. People talk about that year like it only launched the counterculture. The hippies, civil rights, anti-war movements, youth rebellion, all of that. But that's only half the story. Because 1964 also helped plant the modern conservative movement at the exact same time, which honestly feels very cycle-like when you step back far enough. Pressure years do not usually create one future. They split the future into competing realities, and those realities spent the next few decades fighting each other. Barry Goldwater is one of the clearest examples of that. Politically, Goldwater got obliterated in the 1964 election. Lyndon Johnson beat him by nearly 16 million votes. 44 states to 6. That's not a loss. That's electoral taxidermy. Many establishment Republicans treated Goldwater like a dangerous embarrassment. He was too extreme, too aggressive, too anti-establishment, too willing to attack the federal government directly. But underneath the landslide loss, something else was happening. Goldwater's campaign was helping gather conservative energy around a different emotional engine. One of small government, anti-communism, individual freedom, backlash against federal power, fear of rapid cultural change, and growing distrust of elite institutions. Does that sound familiar? A huge amount of modern American conservative politics grows out of that moment, including Reagan, and that's the important part. Goldwater lost the election, but the infrastructure survived. the donors, the messaging, the resentment, the media strategy. Over the next 20 years, that energy helped harden into the modern conservative machine. That's why 1964 matters so much in this cycle idea. It was not one-directional. The pressure point that accelerated civil rights reform also accelerated backlash against civil rights reform. The year that pushed youth rebellion forward also pushed traditional America into defense mode. And the television system broadcasting social change was also broadcasting fear of social change. And television can amplify fear extremely well, as we all know. Sometimes faster than facts, honestly. And then there's the Daisy ad again. One little girl, one nuclear countdown, one paid national airing. And somehow, one of the clearest turning points in modern political media. After that, campaigns had a brutal reminder of something ugly. You do not always need to persuade people rationally if you can emotionally weld your opponent to existential fear. That lesson never went away. It evolved. 1964 may be one of the clearest early moments where television, politics, fear, and psychological pressure all start working together at national scale. And once that door opens, every future cycle inherits a more advanced version of the same machine, which sounds ridiculous until you realize social media already kind of does that now. It just does it badly. While America was busy splitting its political future into two emotional camps, something else happened in 1964 that barely registered for most Americans at the time. But strategically, well, it changed the planet. So at a certain point, I stopped looking at these years individually. And that's where the whole thing gets weird. Because 1 year is trivia. 2 years is interesting. 3 years gets annoying. 4 years makes you open a spreadsheet at 2 a.m. and start questioning your life choices. And once I stacked the years side by side, the pattern stopped feeling like coincidence and started feeling like pressure. Not the same events repeating, because that's important. The details change every cycle. The mechanism, the technology, the way the pressure shows up. But the shape underneath starts looking disturbingly familiar. In 1940, much of the world snaps into total war mode. Propaganda systems mature fast. Entire populations are mobilized through work, fear, rationing, enlistment, and of course, grief. Governments centralize power under existential emergency conditions, while radio and film become mass emotional weapons. Then 24 years later in 1964, television becomes the closest thing America has to a national nervous system. Civil rights rupture the official American story. Vietnam escalates through Tonkin. Youth identity starts detaching from institutional authority. Political emotion becomes televised spectacle. And somewhere in the middle of all that, China detonates its first atomic bomb because apparently the planet needed another source of existential dread. Then 1988. This is where the pattern starts getting harder to ignore. You have Cold War structures destabilize. Global finance accelerates. And the digital skeleton quietly begins crawling underneath civilization while most people are distracted by mall culture, synth music, and pretending fluorescent windbreakers were a good idea. The old world starts dying before most people emotionally realize it's dying. And that matters. Because then comes 2012. And honestly, this is where things start feeling less historical and more psychological. Social media hardens into social infrastructure. Smartphones stop feeling like gadgets and start becoming extensions of how people think. Algorithms begin shaping perception at mass scale. Information overload stops feeling like a problem and starts feeling like the air everybody breathes. The internet stops feeling external and starts feeling environmental. So that is the plasticine moment, the hardening, the lock-in. Not the end of the world, the beginning of the end of consensus reality. And now we're moving toward 2036. And this is where the pattern starts pointing directly at systems we barely understand yet. AI, synthetic media, biotech convergence, machine-written memory, quantum computing pressure, space weather vulnerability, autonomous systems, all of it pushing toward a world where reality can change faster than people can emotionally catch up. And no, before somebody clips this out of context and uploads it with red laser eyes in the thumbnail, I am not saying a magical hidden clock controls civilization. That's too clean. That is not proof of a secret timeline. It is a case for a repeating kind of pressure, a rhythm where roughly every 24 years, the tools people use to understand reality stop working the way they used to. War, media, identity, technology, power, perception. Every cycle mutates the mechanism, but the emotional pattern keeps rhyming. And honestly, the deeper I got into this, the less interested I became in proving the cycle exists, and the more interested I became in one much worse question. Because if 1940 hits the pattern too, then what happens when we go back one more turn of the wheel? So naturally, once you hit 1964, the next question becomes, okay, so what happens if you go back again? And this is where we have to be careful before we turn into one of those guys drawing conspiracy charts on the side of a van. Because history is huge. If you squint hard enough, you can find a pattern in a bowl of soup. But even with that caution in place, the earlier years still get weird. In 1940, much of the world locks into total war mode. Propaganda starts spreading at a global scale. Civilian populations become psychological battlefields. Governments centralize power under existential fear. Then, in 1916, you get Verdun, the Somme, and Europe tearing itself apart, while the old world order starts bleeding out in real time. Then in 1892, industrial monopolies are rising, labor violence is boiling over, mass immigration is reshaping American identity, and the machine age is accelerating faster than society can emotionally process it. The technology changes, the fears change, the systems change too. But a similar pressure keeps showing up. People losing their old sense of identity, power pulling toward the center, technology moving faster than the public can process, and a whole population is trying to absorb too much stress at once. Now, does that prove a hidden cycle controls history? No, of course not. But, documented fact? These years contain major rupture points. Plausible inference? They may rhyme with the same broader pressure pattern. But then the unresolved unknown, whether this is a real cycle or whether we're forcing shapes onto chaos because our brains desperately want history to make sense. But honestly, the deeper I got into this, the less interested I became in proving the cycle exists. The more uncomfortable question is whether civilizations keep passing through bottlenecks, moments that rewrite how people experience reality. And before we chase this thing any further backward, we probably need to ask whether we're seeing a genuine pattern or just getting very good at finding shapes in smoke. At a certain point, I stopped asking whether the pattern was mystical, because honestly, that question started feeling less interesting than the alternative. What if civilizations naturally pulse? Not magically or spiritually. I'm talking about systemically. Because once you strip away the spooky internet coding and look at how societies actually move, cycles show up everywhere. Markets cycle. Empires cycle. Birth rates rise and fall. Crime moves in waves. Political realignments happen in waves. Technological adoption curves bend and break. Even public trust tends to rise and collapse over time. That part is measurable. And societies also change because generations keep handing the wheel to the next group. Roughly every couple decades, a new adult population enters the machine, while the people emotionally shaped by the previous era start losing their grip on the culture. And that matters more than people think, because institutions do not just run on laws, they run on memory, and memory expires. A 22-year-old in 1964 did not emotionally carry World War II the same way their parents did. By 1988, a 22-year-old came of age inside television's saturation and Cold War paranoia. By 2012, that same age group entered adulthood already psychologically fused to the internet. And the people coming into adulthood near 2036? Well, they may be one of the first major generations raised almost entirely inside a reality filtered by algorithms from childhood forward. And that's not philosophy, that's infrastructure. Now, does that prove a repeating 24-year cycle exists? No, not even close. This is where we keep our footing, because human beings are unbelievably good at forcing patterns onto chaos. There's a reason gamblers think roulette tables are talking to them after six drinks and a bad divorce. But there's another problem too. Big systems can create repeating pressure all by themselves. That part is real. Civilizations are not statues. They move. They strain. They react. Media changes behavior. Technology changes perception. Institutions overextend. Trust erodes. Generations rebel against inherited conditions, and eventually, the whole thing starts reorganizing around a new emotional center. That process repeating every few decades would not be shocking to me at all. What is shocking is how closely these pressure years seem to line up once you trace the emotional and technological transitions together. The deeper I got into this, the less the pattern felt like prophecy, and the more it felt like civilization repeatedly hitting moments where reality changes faster than people can absorb it. And if that's true, then maybe the real danger is not that history repeats itself. It may be that human beings keep mistaking systemic transformation for isolated events, because we're trapped inside the middle of the change. The thing that keeps bothering me about 1964 isn't really the politics, it's the feeling. Go watch the old interviews, street footage, and news clips from that year. Not the cleaned-up nostalgia versions with warm documentary music playing over them. I'm talking about the real stuff. People look like they can feel something changing, even if they cannot fully explain what it is yet. You can see it in the interviews, in the crowds, in the way people talk. The old world is still standing there physically, but emotionally, it already sounds tired. And the new world coming in behind it feels faster, louder, stranger, more synthetic somehow. That part feels uncomfortably familiar, because most generations assume the world they grew up in is the stable version. Then one day, they look around and realize the emotional rules changed while they were busy living their lives. Suddenly the language is different. The technology feels invasive. Institutions stop feeling trustworthy. Reality itself starts feeling sped up. And nobody can fully agree on when it happened. That's the eerie part. Most people living through what we might call a reset probably do not experience it as history. They experience it as exhaustion, confusion, background anxiety, the sense that the culture they understood yesterday no longer reacts the same way today. Maybe that's why these cycles are so hard to see while they're happening. Because when you're inside the transition, it just feels like life getting weird. But then decades later, somebody stacks the footage side by side and realizes the whole culture may have shifted underneath everybody's feet. So maybe 1964 was one of those moments. Maybe 1988 was too. Maybe 2012 hardened something we still do not fully understand. And maybe 2036 is already starting now in ways we are too close to recognize clearly. Honestly, I don't know. But I do know this. The people in 1964 had no idea what the next 24 years were about to become. They didn't know the next era would bring Vietnam, Watergate, assassinations, oil shocks, cults, cable news, and the early bones of the digital world. They were just trying to live, pay their bills, raise their kids, get through the week, same as us. That's the part that sticks with me. Because if we're standing in our own version of 1964 right now, we probably won't recognize it as history either. We'll call it stress. We'll call it politics or technology. Just the news being insane again. Life getting weird. And by the time the pattern is obvious, the scariest part may not be that we can see the cycle. It may be that seeing it still does not change a damn thing. Thanks for being here tonight. If you want more stories like this, you know where to find me, you know where the links are. And if you choose to support the channel, it really helps. I'll see you next time.